Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Democratic presidential candidates want to eliminate the Electoral College, and it's one of their best applause lines, according to reporters. Could this really happen? Plus, GOP senators are preparing to change Senate rules to ease the path to confirmation votes for executive nominees and even some judges. We'll tell you what that means going forward. Welcome. I'm Paul Jugo with The Wall Street Journal and here with my colleague Kim Strassel to talk about these items. Hello, Kim.
Hello, Paul.
So here we are. The Electoral College is a kind of fascinating moment. I mean, it's in many ways a hardy perennial in American politics, the frustration with the Electoral College, particularly among parties that lose electoral vote after they've won the popular vote. Hillary Clinton, of course, that happened to her. It happened to Al Gore as well. So Democrats now are the party that are really challenging the Electoral College. And what we have Elizabeth Warren now saying it should be abolished. We have Beto O'Rourke saying, well, we certainly should look at it in his on one hand, on the other hand kind of way. And then some of the other Democratic candidates are also getting into it. Pete Buttigieg of the mayor from Indiana is already saying it's got to go. So I guess this has now become something, Kim, of a party-wide position among Democrats.
Yeah, you can see why they're doing it, too. This reflects the rage and unhappiness that Donald Trump is president, and it's a bit of a sour grapes position, and as you say, one that losing parties have thrown out as a talking point in the past. What's different this time is that, you know, you have leading presidential contenders making the claim. Kamala Harris just last night also on Jimmy Kimmel Live
said
she was open to a discussion about this. So they seem to be leading with it. Now it's probably designed just to rally the voters and get them out. It would be highly unlikely that they could ever effect such a change, at least not through a constitutional amendment. But it's a voter energization plan at the moment.
It's also something of a free issue in the sense that because it would involve amending the Constitution. We're going to tell you about a way that states are trying to eliminate the Electoral College without going to the Constitution. But the Electoral College is part of the Constitution, so it would require a constitutional amendment to change to a popular vote. And in that sense, it's like a lot of these things that the people come out and politicians campaign for this or that constitutional amendment. Well, great. You get credit for proposing it, but it's never going to happen.
Right. And it's also a free issue in that it's an easy line to say, well, majority rules should be the law of the land without going into any of the very complex and important reasons that the founders put the Electoral College in place, one of which is that, you know, the majority in their view was not necessarily the basis for how we elect a president in a republic. And I think that in a weird way, because Democrats have not had to go through the mechanics of this or make any sophisticated argue about it or even think it through much, because, as you say, it's not likely to happen. I don't think they've thought about some of the ramifications that could actually not be great for their party if it did go into place.
Well, let's talk about those ramifications a bit. The one of which is that the Electoral College does have the benefit of channeling the electoral system, the candidates into the electoral system in a two-party system where you get a clear choice between one or the other. It tends to diminish the appeal of third-party candidates because they end up in the end not being likely to win any particular states, for example. And if you can't win states, then you can't win through the Electoral College. It's one of the reasons Mike Bloomberg didn't run, for example. And so it tends to deter third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth. And believe me, there might be eighth or ninth party candidates from running if you had just a sheer popular vote contest. And because of that, the Electoral College tends to produce an electoral – it produces an Electoral College majority. And so even if there's a plurality of the popular vote, you get a Electoral College majority and therefore a certain legitimacy – electoral legitimacy that might be harder to come by if all you did was come up and go by a popular vote total that, let's say, somebody won a popular vote of 36% in a multi-party field. Does that make you more or less legitimate as a president than somebody who narrowly lost the popular vote but won the electoral vote?
Right. Well, let's take what Democrats are suggesting they would like to see happen and apply it in a fictitious way to the coming presidential election. Let's say that we tomorrow went to a majority rules situation and you had Donald Trump running on the Republican side. And then you had not only the Democratic candidate who won their nomination, but a number of the other Democrats who lost but still wanted to run for the presidency, all running as third party left of center candidates. So one Republican, four or five left of center candidates who divide the vote. Would they be happy in a situation, as you just said, in which Donald Trump won the presidency with only 30%? Of the vote or 40% of the vote, it decreases legitimacy even more.
The another issue is the fact that the states do the counting, right, in each instance to come up with their allocation of the electoral votes. And if you had every year we have controversies on ballot counting in all kinds of jurisdictions, but they're usually irrelevant to the ultimate outcome, not just because some of the vote totals are large, but because in any given state, it may not make a difference. But if you had a popular vote total that was close and you had a controversy in California, you had a controversy in North Carolina, you had a controversy in Florida and so on, you could have weeks and months of waiting for the vote counting to come to be finally determined, along with enormous frustration and anger and questioning of what's honest ballot counting, what isn't honest ballot counting. I covered, Kim, the 2000 controversy between Gore and Bush, and I can tell you that that was no picnic. That was pretty ugly in some ways, and that was just one state. What if you had this happen in half dozen states or 20?
No, it's an excellent point. And on the state point, there is one other claim that Democrats make, which has not really been parsed, but is absolutely opposite to the argument that they're making. I saw Elizabeth Warren, and I think she was in Mississippi when she made her comments about the Electoral College. And she said, you know what the problem is you people in this state, you don't count. The candidates don't come out here and see you because they're all running around Iowa and Ohio. And that's been one of the charges among those that complain about the Electoral College, is that there are certain states whose votes supposedly don't count as much, or voters who don't matter as much. But in fact, if you step back and you look at the Electoral College, what it does is it forces candidates to, in fact, campaign across the country and pay attention to wider swaths of the country than they might otherwise. If all it took to win the presidency was a majority vote, you would only ever campaign in the highest population areas, California, for instance, or New York, or areas of Florida. No one would ever step foot into the interior. And while, yes, every candidate makes different choices these days under the Electoral College as to which states are going to target, and sometimes sometimes they don't visit them, and sometimes to their peril. I mentioned Wisconsin and Hillary Clinton. You know, for the most part, this system requires people to cater to different states and different voter groups within states that they might otherwise ignore.
We're talking about the Electoral College, and you're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kim Strassel. We're talking about the movement among Democrats to abolish the electoral college system of electing presidents of the United States. And just to elaborate on your last point, Kim, if you were Donald Trump and you're running in 2020, say, and you want to, it's a popular vote election, where are you going to spend your time? You're going to spend your time in Houston, Dallas, Florida. You're going to spend it in places where there are populous states with large amounts of conservative voters. If you're, let's say, Kamala Harris running, you're going to do the same. You're going to do in L.A., New York. You're going to do Philly. You're going to do big cities with large majorities of Democratic voters. And, you know, you're not going to go to Wausau, Wisconsin. You're not going to go to Green Bay, Wisconsin. You're not going to go to places where you do go now because of the Electoral College. Now, North Dakota probably isn't going to get a presidential visit anyway.
And anytime soon, no.
Right. But still, it at least is more relevant in an Electoral College sense, because if you get a close close contest in the Electoral College, those three electoral votes could be decisive.
Right. It requires you to pay attention to those states that allow you to get 270 votes in the Electoral College. And as we know from every presidential election we watch and cover, everyone has different paths for doing that. And there are many different paths and many different ways that you can do to assemble that number. And you never know precisely which state could end up being, the margin of difference in the end. I remember in this last election, everyone was talking about all the different districts in Maine, and because that is a state that splits and can put electors toward different people, and everyone was trying to cater to certain parts of the state. And that's a good thing for democracy, in that, you know, we have a lot of voters in the middle, in particular in suburban areas, the independent voters, a lot of parts of the country where the electorate is divided kind of 50-50. None of those would get much attention under a majority rules system.
Let's talk about something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And this is moving through some of the states. It would mean, if you sign up to it, it means that you say that your electoral votes under the system will be applied to the winner of the national popular vote. Right? Is that? Do I have that right, Kim?
So that, yes. No matter what your voters voted for, all right, of your electors would go to the winner of the popular vote.
So even if Colorado voted as a majority for Trump, if the popular vote at the national level was Clinton, then the Colorado's electoral votes would go to Clinton.
Correct.
So in the name of making a popular national election, you would say to your state's voters, sorry, you're just part of the grand national melting pot. You don't have any particular relevance here other than you're just you're dwarfed by California or Texas.
Yeah, it's somewhat stunningly obnoxious to your own voters and to the entire state system that has operated at in most of these states up until now. And I think the remarkable thing is, so Colorado is opting into this. And if you have the governors of New Mexico and Delaware, who are also looking to potentially sign legislation that would have them join this as well too, you'd have 14 states equaling 189 electoral votes in the end. Now, they would need, under this legislation, you would need 270 before it would go operational in all of these states. And I think there are very serious reasons to believe that this is utterly unconstitutional. So they have a way to go. But, you know, it's not inconceivable, Paul, that if sometime down the road Democrats had a really monster election where they made big gains at the state level, that you could potentially get enough states to get to that 270.
My suspicion is that it would be ruled and be challenged and ruled as unconstitutional by some states that would claim they'd been disenfranchised, and be challenged as unconstitutional. But in the interim, it would add certainly to the uncertainty and maybe political corrosive uncertainty about our electoral system. So, but it's all fascinating. We'll see how it goes as a political issue going forward. One other point I should make. Donald Trump, as you might have expected, has changed his mind about the Electoral College. A few years back, he was denouncing it as the worst possible system. And of course, now he says, well, you know, it has some real benefits, I guess, not least electing him.
He's got a plan for 2 years from now.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Let's talk briefly about the plan by the Republican Senate, which you've written about a couple of times, they're preparing to change Senate rules to expedite the confirmation of nominees for executive branch positions and district court judges. Kim, you think this is a good idea?
It's a great idea. And we now have the two men who've been pushing this in the Senate, Roy Blunt from Missouri and Jim Lankford from Oklahoma. They have a proposal, and what it would do is reduce the amount of debate time or post-cloture time before you can have a final vote on these particular nominees to about 2 hours. This is not necessarily a radical change. It was the rule of the Senate back in 2013 when Republicans agreed to such a proposal by then Democratic leader Harry Reid. But Democrats are in an obstructionist mood. It's why Republicans are going here in the first place, because they continue to demand, to obstruct and demand the full 30 hours of debate time on every single nominee that comes through. It's made it very hard to confirm a Trump administration. So there are hundreds of nominees outstanding, and the two men who have been pushing this say that they now believe they have 51 votes to pass it unilaterally, only with Republican support.
They would like to do this with 60 votes, though, and get the Democrats on board, wouldn't they? They've been trying. Yeah. And the reason for Democrats should sign on is because what goes around comes around, and if there's a Democratic administration in 2021, as there may very well be, and a Republican Senate, well, even if there's a minority Republican, 48 votes, 47, then they can do the same thing to slow down the confirmation votes, advice and consent against a Democratic president's nominees.
Well, that's right. And I think the other reason that they ought to support this is, again, this was something they agreed to the last time around. The number of hours that would now be allowed, which is 2 hours, is slightly less than the former proposal, which was more like eight. But that former proposal was an acknowledgement by both sides, and it was a bipartisan deal back then, that the 30 hours is simply unnecessary for many of these nominees, you know, the assistant attorney, assistant however smaller position in some place here or there, that 2 hours, by the time you get to the debate phase, they've been through confirmation hearings, they've had investigations done on them, every senator's been allowed to meet them and ask questions if they want. So you don't need 30 hours of debate. And moreover, this proposal retains in it safeguards against the bigger positions. So it does not account for Supreme Court nominees, appeals court nominees, cabinet secretaries, and many of the boards and commissions that we have out there that are important and play important roles. So this is something that, as you said, just it's a thoughtful proposal, one Democrats have believed in before and one that could help them in the future.
The reference you make to being done in the recent past was when Harry Reid was the Democratic majority leader of the Senate and President Obama was in the White House. He went to Republicans, Mitch McConnell, and said, the minority leader then, and said, hey, how about reducing this 30-hour rule to 8? And McConnell agreed with that, right?
Yes, and a number of Republicans agreed with that in the end. Now, it was part of a bigger agreement they made that had to do with some nominees that some people wanted through. But it was part of a change to move the Senate forward. And I think Republicans feel a little miffed that Democrats won't go along now with what a change that they viewed as eminently reasonable only a few years ago.
All right. And this could happen as quickly as what? Next week, we gather, when they return from recess.
Yeah, and I think it's notable that Blunt said he believes they have 51 votes because, you know, the Republicans only have a 53-seat majority, and there have been some members, in particular Susan Collins, who is up for re-election in Maine this coming cycle. She's expressed some reluctance to go the Republican-only route, but they can afford to lose a couple of people, and I find it unlikely that Blunt would be out there saying they had 51 if they hadn't done some nose counting.
All right. Thank you, Kim. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later in the week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.